This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, an organization devoted to producing and distributing Reformed theological content for a connected age. Online at reformedforum.org. This is the Reformed Media Review, episode number 38. Today we speak with Carl Truman about his new book, Republicrat. Welcome to the Reformed Media Review, your regular look at books and culture from a Reformed perspective. My name is Camden Busey. We've got a great panel here today, a very special edition of the Reformed Media Review. We're actually going to review a book with the author present. sort of unusual. Usually we do this sort of thing on Christ the Center, but we're very excited on Reformed Media Review to have a wonderful panel. Introducing first, we have Jonathan Brack, who is admissions counselor, as well as an MDiv student at Westminster Theological Seminary. Welcome over, Jonathan. It's great to have you.
Thanks, Camden.
We also have Jared Oliphant, who is Director of Admissions at Westminster. It's great to have you here, Jared.
Good to be here.
And these two guys have done some great work. You can find most of it at WTS.edu, but their social media stuff is at YouTube.com/Westminster Online and Facebook.com/Westminster Online. But without further ado, let me introduce to you our special guest today. It is Dr. Carl Truman, who is Professor of Historical Theology and Church History, as well as the Vice President for Academic Affairs right here at Westminster Theological Seminary. Welcome to the program, Dr. Truman. Thanks for coming over.
It's great to be here, Camden. Thanks for asking me.
We have a long walk from your office right over here. We're actually broadcasting from Westminster today. We're very privileged to do so in a little room. We've got some gear set up. And today we're going to be speaking about a new book that Dr. Truman has written. It's not even out yet, and I believe we're the first to speak about it publicly. It's titled Republicrat, Confessions of a Liberal Conservative. It's a book on politics and sort of a lament about the current state of the American political landscape. We're going to dive into the world of politics, looking at it from a Reformed perspective and trying to ask some very deep and basic questions about how we engage politically. Just to get things started, Dr. Truman, you mentioned in the book that you were asked to write this. Well, what drew you to the topic enough to say yes, especially even to PNR, a political book with a Reformed publisher?
Yeah, true.
Yeah, well, I was approached by Marvin Padgett and Ian Thompson of PNR, who said they wanted somebody to write a book which was essentially offering a critique of the current political climate and culture in the United States. In particular, the alliance that often exists between very conservative politics and conservative theology. And I've always had a particular hankering to write on subjects that are not controversial and won't get me into trouble. So this seemed like a natural choice at the time. Yeah. No, seriously, I've always had an interest in politics. I'm particularly concerned by what I see as the cliched and unnuanced nature of so much political discussion today. And it's not just an American problem. I think it's a general problem in Western democracies as a whole. Personally, also disturbed by what I see as an increasingly anger-driven and fear-driven agenda by the religious right that I don't think is culturally and socially helpful or healthy, either for society or for the church. And also, perhaps equally disturbed by what I see as the smug self-righteousness of so much of the evangelical left that I think adopts the moral high ground so often and sees an unbreakable connection often between revising classical orthodox theology and holding socially and politically liberal views. So there are a variety of concerns that made me interested in the project when it was proposed.
Well, speaking of the political left, you give a good historical background in the first chapter. I was wondering, can you talk a little bit about the connection that you make between psychological oppression and quote-unquote authenticity and the implications that have been borne out with those distinctions in evangelicalism in particular?
Sure. I think one of the problems I see with the evangelical political left is very few of the writers, if any of the writers that I've looked at, seem to have any great understanding of what's actually happened within the secular left politically over the last 50 or 60 years. I think what happens on the secular left is as the socialist and left-wing parties in Europe by and large lost the economic arguments. Particularly the Marxist left moved in a direction where they essentially redefined what they understood by oppression. I think 100 mm-hmm. years ago on the left, it was very clear that oppression was, it was an economic category whereby some people possessed things that other people didn't possess. That was deemed to be the result of social inequities of some kind, mm-hmm. and the government could be involved in helping to right those perceived wrongs. By the time you get to the 50s and 60s, I think it's beginning to dawn on the secular left that poor people don't aspire to political liberation. They aspire merely to owning more stuff. Mm. And that led to a shift in left-wing philosophy that began to see oppression less as a function of economics mm-hmm. and more as something psychological. Mm-hmm. The obvious examples of this would be the way that the left has essentially morphed from offering economic critique of Western society these days to offering something that is little more than agendas for various forms of political identity, mm-hmm. for want of a better term. Think of racial politics, you can think of the politics of sexuality. All of these things have come to define the left in a way that, to put it bluntly, quite often the real poor in society have been left behind. Mm-hmm. The left are now more concerned about whether Melissa Etheridge can marry her partner mm-hmm. than they are about whether there are, you know, the streets of Philadelphia are clean, whether kids in Philadelphia have decent health care, decent housing, decent sanitation. And that, I think, is a real moral problem on the left. The way that spilled over into evangelicalism, I think that so often evangelicals have picked up the identity politics of the left without realizing that that emphasis on identity politics arises out of specific crises in the left in the 50s and 60s. And so the evangelical left often doesn't, to me, embody the values that, say, my grandfather, who was a trade unionist all his life, the struggle of my grandfather for political and economic help for the poorest people in society, that has been left by the wayside. Mm-hmm. Now the struggle is for that middle-class women shouldn't be oppressed by having abortion limited. Mm-hmm. That gay people should be allowed to marry. And there are serious debates to be had on all of those issues.
Right.
But they're, of little importance compared to the emphasis on speaking up for the poor, speaking up for those who can't speak for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned speaking up for the poor, and in the book you talk about the liberal sort of tenet or the traditional liberal tenet of giving a voice to those who can't be heard. And then you go on to say that that has been ignored as far as the issue of abortion is concerned.
Absolutely. I think the sign of biggest moral crisis on the left has to be abortion. If ever there was an issue where the left should be pro-life, if you like, it's abortion.
Yeah.
For me, being liberal, being left of center, is about speaking up for those who don't have the power and position to speak up for themselves. And the individuals that applies to most, of course, are children in the womb. It was very interesting to me last year, it was 2 years ago now, when Rick Warren was invited to pray at President Obama's inauguration.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know much about Rick Warren's theology. I'm sure we would have significant differences theologically. But what struck me as interesting was the way the left reacted to Warren's, the invitation to Warren. Here's a man whose church, from what I can make out, has been involved in all kinds of social activities of which the left would surely approve.
Yeah.
The provision of clean water in Africa, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
But all that counted for nothing. Mm-hmm. Because he was pro-life and he was opposed to gay marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And it struck me as interesting that that was enough to have him written off by the left.
Mm.
quite remarkable. They couldn't even say, well, he does quite a lot of good here and we don't agree with him there. They couldn't even nuance it to that extent. The fact that he was opposed to gay marriage and opposed to abortion was enough to finish him as far as they were concerned. And it was fascinating watching some of these very wealthy, well-paid TV pundits. You know, I don't know how much money they give to help poor people, how much money they give to provide clean water in Africa, listening to them pontificating very self-righteously about Rick Warren and the invitation that had been extended to him.
Now, on a more historical level, what do you think occurred the shift from that tenet of speaking up for those who can't, who don't have a voice, to, or what would you even say is the sort of underlying cliche liberal tenet these days? Would you have an opinion on that at all? Or?
It goes back in some ways to the answer I gave to the first question. I think that the definition of oppression has come to be seen as something psychological. Mm-hmm. And again, one thing I didn't mention in my first answer was I think there's a kind of fusion of Marx and Freud that takes place in the 1950s, particularly in the work of Herbert Marcuse and the Frankfurt School. There is this sort of meeting of Marx and Freud. The shifting of oppression to the psychological or the psychosexual kind of categories opens the way for the oppressed, those without a voice, to be anybody who's marginalized by anybody else, effectively. What that comes down to in practice is, if you've got a lobby group, you can have an identity politics.
Yeah, that's right. Now, what are some of the... You have an interesting perspective, not being an American citizen, coming from the UK. I know you're not Welsh. I'll say that right now. In fact, Chad Van Dixhorn this morning said, it's really difficult to find in the minutes any good theology coming from Wales.
That doesn't surprise me. I could have told him that before he even started his studies. But
you say early on in the book, in the chapter, The Slipperiness of Secularization, I love the time you spend on these chapters. It just the titles even got me chuckling a little bit. But You're intentionally coming from an outsider's view, and the outsider looking in, you mentioned that you're just so surprised initially at how explicitly religious American politics is. How is American politics different on a macro scale from what you find over in the UK?
In answering this question, of course, I'm really talking about the UK of 9 years ago.
Yeah,
it's quite possible that the UK has shifted in the time that I've been away. I would say American politics is driven much more by personalities and celebrities. That, I think, is in part a reflection of the wider American culture. You even see this in sport. Yeah. In Britain, the focus is usually on the teams. Mm. It's Man United or it's Liverpool. Yeah. You'll get the occasional figure who, like David Beckham who
Rooney.
Rises as a single individual. But by and large, the focus is on the team. Mm-hmm. In America, it's very interesting that the focus is often on the individuals within the teams. And I see politics, party politics, in some ways as a function of that wider celebrity culture. So there's an emphasis on individual personalities and on character here, I think, that you don't find in the United Kingdom.
What about the citizens and the way they take to certain types of language and certain types of angles?
I think there is Britain and America have very different, I hate to sound too postmodernist, but they're very different stories.
Yeah.
Very different narratives, if you like. The American narrative is a kind of forward-looking, pioneer, rugged individual narrative. The British narrative over the last 100 years has really been that of decline and fall. Our great century was the 19th, early 20th century.
I believe that decline and fall started a little over 200 years ago.
On the next episode, we discuss the UK.
We won't mention the War of 1812 in that case. But some would have seen the loss of the colonies actually as a dramatic improvement, but it certainly saved us from baseball, if I could put it that way. I think the class structure of Britain is much more explicit in the way that voting goes on as well. So if America is a celebrity culture, Britain, at least when I left it, was still very much a class-oriented culture.
does the political language reflect that culture then, in terms of if you've got celebrities and the focus in the U.S. is on celebrities and personalities, is the rhetoric just geared toward that and you don't find that overseas?
To an extent in America, I think the rhetoric is geared towards individuals. I think of Sarah Palin and John McCain as, you know, the Mavericks. That was, to me, the Mavericks were a country and western band. I seem to remember.
Oh, yeah.
Here it strikes real resonance at election time. Yeah. So there is that element. I think in Britain, if somebody was described as a maverick, it would not play particularly well. Again, because Britain is now in a sort of period of decline of empire. We feel, you know, some people feel very guilty about the empire. Patriotism is a somewhat dirty word.
Mm.
So patriotic rhetoric doesn't play well in elections quite often.
I believe your father made you told a story about your father making a comment about the flags when he was out here. You took him on a ride and people had flags hanging up on their homes, and he was just so surprised that people would want to hang a flag.
Oh yeah, there is no cult of the flag in I remember as a teenager in the early 80s when the Libyan students were always burning the British and American flags. And we used to watch the television and laugh and think, you know, those crazy Libyans, what will they get up to next?
Those Libyans.
But I now realize that to an American, the burning of the American flag is just about the most offensive thing that a foreign person could do. So we don't have quite the same allegiance to the flag that you have here. And partly that's because the whole notion of national identity is somewhat different in Britain to here. The great thing about being an American is anybody can become an American.
Mm-hmm.
It's a set of ideas. Britain, it's much more to do with sort of blood and soil, if
right.
I could put it that way. And that makes a difference as well.
It's all in the narrative.
Yeah.
I want to come back to story. Actually, I have a couple quotes that I want to read that directly address that. But I want to get back a little earlier in the book. Just a quote that's on page 33. This is just such a great quote. I want to just kind of hear your thoughts about it in elaboration. It says, "Biblical salvation history is not repeated or recapitulated in the history of the United States or any other nation for that matter. To claim such is puerile, blasphemous nonsense, as bad, if not worse, as anything Osteen might say in a sermon. And it represents nothing other than the secularization of the gospel message to an idolatrous degree." I love that quote because it comments on that whole Christian America, we're kind of the new Israel type of politics.
If I wrote it again, I'd tell you what I really thought.
I know. So you hold back a lot here, which is interesting. But just wanted to get your thought. Can you elaborate that on, you know, a little bit, coming from both a British perspective and from the perspective of teaching theology at Westminster, how those two things fit together?
I think it's when I write that, it's very much against the background of what I see happen, what I saw, understand to have happened through my reading of sort of English texts in the late 19th century. If you go back to England, I say very specifically England at this point, not just Britain, because it was the English rather than the Scots and the Welsh that really thought of themselves as the power and normative for the rest of humanity. If you look at England in the late 19th century, you really see a very close identification there between the destiny of the nation and the will of God. And that's repeated. If you go, there are various cultures you can go to, and you see that at the zenith of their power, often in artwork, in literature, in representation, the state or the leader of the state is represented in almost godlike terms. Nazi Germany, Mussolini's Italy would be two great examples.
Yeah.
You could go back to ancient Rome, the eternal city. Yeah. Any empire, one might say, at the zenith of its power, tends to identify itself with the meaning of history. And if there's any theistic belief behind that, therefore identifying itself with the will of God and the destiny of God's people. The particular quote you read was from a passage in the book where I'm dealing with this thing called the Patriot's Bible. You look it up on the internet, you can find it. It is very explicit that there is a parallel between Adam and Eve and George and Martha Washington. There is a parallel between the Last Supper and the Continental Congress. It's connected. I'm not sure if it's on that website or another website. There is a sort of painting of, you know, great Christians in America where there's a lovely picture of Jesus in the middle, holding up not the Ten Commandments, but I think it's the Constitution of the United States or the Declaration of Independence.
Bill of Rights.
Surrounded by great Christians from America's history, including, among others, Tom Paine. Now, I'm a great admirer of Tom Paine as a political pamphleteer and English prose stylist. I think the man was a genius at popular rhetoric. But I think he'd be deeply offended to have been thought of as one of America's early Christian founding fathers. Man was very much on the radical end of the religious spectrum. But what I see the Patriot's Bible and that picture representing is the identification of a nation at the height of its world power with the will of God. And I think that's very, very dangerous. And ironically, I think quite often that way of thinking has more to do with, in its modern philosophical rationale, with Hegel and Marx than it does with biblical eschatology, quite frankly.
That's interesting. You did bring up Hegel and Marx and their idea that assumption, really, that we're heading towards some ultimate point. And you tie that in, could you explain to the listener how that feeds into the idea of consumerism and this dissatisfaction with the present and a desire to head toward, it's really an eschatology of goods and economy, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the free market society as it's developed in its current form, if you like, is predicated on dissatisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
Markets continually need to be recreated. How do you recreate a market? Well, there are a number of ways you can do it. One, there's built-in obsolescence. Every 5 years, I have to replace my refrigerator. We could put a man on the moon. Surely we can build a refrigerator that lasts for 60, 80, or 100 years. Of course we can. But if you do that, nobody's going to buy
keep
it.
Buying refrigerators.
Planned obsolescence.
Aesthetics play into this. We keep sort of changing the aesthetics of things. I see you're sitting there with a MacBook.
Yeah. Well, that's the old one, you could tell.
Yeah.
I've fallen with the new iPhone because it looks different than the last one.
But it still makes telephone calls probably.
Right. They do.
No more efficiently than the last one.
Apple's
in
the
fact,
perfect
possibly
company.
Even less efficient.
Drop the calls. But you're exactly right. Even the way companies market, they're intending for their products to be obsolete in a few years so that they can sell you more.
Yeah. And this whole ethos also cultivates an iconoclastic mindset towards the past.
Mm.
I think it's dangerous for Christianity because Christianity is predicated on the idea that the faith is not reinvented every Sunday, that it's not a new product every Sunday or every 2 weeks. We're actually standing in a line that goes back to the empty tomb and before that of saints who've enjoyed the Lord's blessing over the years. And the idea of being perpetually dissatisfied with the past and the present, I think, is antithetical to a lot of what Christianity stands for.
Now, one thing on this point I found just a little bit lacking in your book, I would have preferred a nota bene when you mentioned Mott the Hoople. And maybe I don't know if a lot of readers will understand what in the world that is.
Well, Mott the Hoople were a rock band that actually did the definitive version of All the Young Dudes.
David Bowie.
Well, most people know that as a David Bowie song. I didn't know that, actually. But if you compare the two, you will realize that Mott the Hoople were superior in their rendition.
Many of the same ways of how Manfred Mann were superior in Blinded by the Light, even though Bruce Springsteen wrote it.
Mm. And I think probably on Quinn the Eskimo. And it's not often that I would rank Dylan second to anybody on
Well, there it is, your bonus on Reformed Media Review. As you're reading the chapter, Living Life to the Max. Max is Max Weber.
Yeah, good chapter.
You can understand when you get to Mott the Hoople now what that is. Jonathan.
I did have a question about what we're referring to with consumerism and the idea that America is sort of the new country of God, and it's God's country, God's blessing. And we see that a lot in political language throughout the history of America. Would you say that the first thing that comes to my mind is sort of an early form of transformational eschatology? Would you say that that's a fair assessment of a type of the eschaton, our God's kingdom, is now this place here on earth. And look what we did. We fought and we bled to make sort of heaven on earth.
City on a hill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think probably there's some of that in the roots of it. I suspect that in the modern situation, it's not as it's not thought out as deeply and reflectively as that.
Yeah.
It's more of a gut instinct that everybody has that their nation is the best.
Mm.
Even the Welsh.
Yeah.
Think they're the best. Yeah. The English think they're the best. America thinks it's the best, and it's bigger and stronger than everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So I suspect it's just, on one level, a kind of jingoism attached to immense economic strength and power.
I think some of that's even changing, though, now with the changing landscapes in Russia and China, especially. Yeah. And
India, yeah. India
some
as
of,
well.
Some of us right. Americans who've always thought of us as the superpower are starting to see, well, we're probably not tomorrow's superpower, and starting to reevaluate some of our philosophy.
And I think that's a very healthy thing. It's very much akin to what was happening in Rome in the 4th, 5th centuries. As Rome goes into decline, and it causes a cultural and intellectual crisis, and
it
produces Augustine's City of God. Augustine's City of God is an extended reflection on how do I make sense of God's will in the light of the fact that Rome, the eternal city, is in decline and is falling.
Now, speaking of chapter 3, where we could use a healthy dose of Augustine, the chapter is titled Not So Fantastic Mr. Fox. And Fox refers to Fox News.
That is,
so
like, what
this
a great
is
title.
A little apropos, especially around here. What's the deal with Fox News, and how does this fit into the Christian America movement and consumerism and marketability?
Yeah, what is the deal with Fox News? I'd like to know that.
I know.
My purely anecdotal response at this point is that it does seem to me, from people I chat to in church and in the wider Christian world, that Fox News is not only the preferred news channel, but often the only news channel that many conservative Christians watch.
Right.
Now, I'm well aware that there is no such thing as a neutral presentation of the news. History is my trade. I know that news, like writing history, you're selecting sources, you're presenting them in certain ways.
Mm-hmm.
What concerns me is if you only ever go to the one source, you have no critical handle on how that source is handling the news.
Mm-hmm.
So that chapter is in some ways a twofold agenda. One, to strike a blow against those who on more than one occasion have said to me, Fox News, that's the neutral channel. It isn't the neutral channel. Rupert Murdoch and his media empire have a clear agenda. That agenda is, by the way, to make money more
That's
than
true.
It is to promote conservative politics.
Yeah.
And secondly, it's to encourage people to read and to watch programs that wind them up and upset them. Look at the alternative viewpoints. Hear what they have to say, because it's only by listening to the various sides of a debate that you can actually start to become more informed yourself.
Yeah, you're definitely finding that online and in the websites that and all the rhetoric that these television news programs fit into. And it's not just the right either, and you make that clear in the book too. You find the same thing on the left, but it's just wise to not get any news from one single source. I try to mix it up, not setting myself as some great example, but I watch my little bit of Glenn Beck here and there, and I listen to the Best of the Left podcast, which gets me my Olbermann and Maddow and John Stewart and all that. So then I listen to my conspiracy theory podcast, No Agenda, I listen to sometimes. So that gives me the really wackos. But if you don't do that, you're just hearing the cliches, you say.
Yeah.
And what are the effects of the political cliche, especially from the right, on the American political landscape?
I think there are various results of the kind of cliches that you see coming out. One, I think, is just the death of nuanced critical thinking.
Mm-hmm.
That's a problem. Secondly, I think particularly with the way the right present matters, I think it generates fear. I think they trade on fear a lot of the time, that there is this vast conspiracy out there out to get you and to get yours. And, you know, if I sat and watched Glenn Beck every night and that was my primary source for news, I'd be living in a pretty scary world.
I know.
I'd be scared too.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
it's wild, a lot of it.
Yeah.
And I Oz Guinness, when he was here a few months ago and gave a seminar the morning of graduation, made the point. He said somebody asked him, could you give an example of the sort of the death of thoughtfulness and courtesy in our society? And he said, the mailings you receive from the religious right.
Mm-hmm.
He said, open them up and look at the words that are highlighted.
Mm-hmm.
He said, they are all words that relate to anger, fear, and conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's tragic that one might say the death of decency
mm-hmm.
is becoming so associated with religion. A lot of my non-Christian friends here, they're frightened of evangelicals, and frankly, with good reason, some of them, because the way they behave can really be quite scary.
And not to, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think just to be clear on these kinds of issues, it's you're not saying, okay, therefore you should be a Democrat, therefore you should be a Republican, or therefore democracy is great, or capitalism. I think your point is we should think about all of these issues from a critical biblical standpoint, and that means every party, every political system is subjected to really the word of God.
If I'd written this book in a society where the knee-jerk, default, unthinking position of Christians was to vote for a left-wing party, it would have been a very different book.
Sure.
Yeah.
In some ways, I hope the overall effect would have been the same, but the examples I would have been using would have been very, very different.
Yeah.
So I'm sure there are those out there who will read the book and see it as one long liberal manifesto.
Right.
And certainly I would root my own politics in Britain. If I was in Britain, my politics would be slap bang in the middle.
Uh-huh.
That puts me somewhat on the left, I think,
right.
in America.
Yeah, sure.
But it's not a party political broadcast for any political party. What it's saying is politics is complicated. It requires thoughtfulness. Unfortunately, when you go into a voting booth, you've got to tick one box or the other.
That's the problem.
There's no nuance in the democratic process when it terminates, but that's no excuse for not being as informed and as thoughtful as you can be before you go into that voting booth.
Yeah.
That was the part of the book that actually convicted me as far as my politics are concerned. I grew up, of course, conservative. And I would say I'm generally conservative, but I'm more theological than I am political. And so when I would listen to radio programs that are usually on the right, I sometimes I'm like, oh, that sounds good. That sounds good. And then as soon as they say anything about religion or scripture, I immediately think that was absolutely wrong. They're out to lunch on those issues. And it's funny that I find that I'm inconsistent there, where I'll just sort of take in what they say politically, but then as soon as it comes to theology, I get extremely critical, when I need to be critical in all areas and not just blindly accept anything because it sounds good to something that I'm used to hearing.
That's happened to me, too, when I've been listening to Bill O'Reilly, and then all of a sudden he goes on a diatribe against something in the tech world or something I'm very familiar with, and I hear how far off it is. It makes me wonder, like, what? You know, I don't have the ability to be as critical without helps on other things, but that doesn't excuse me from just listening uncritically. It can open your eyes, and it's not just the right. Again, it's from all sides.
I think the media present politics in this country, by and large, in very Manichaean terms.
Yes. Yeah.
It's all about goodies versus baddies.
Yeah,
depends whether you're Republican or Democrat as to who the goodies are and who the baddies are. But essentially, there are no redeeming features on the other side. And your side have essentially got it basically all right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a real problem.
You get someone like John McCain who has in the past worked with, crossed the aisle, as it were, and worked with people from the other party. And he gets roundly criticized for it.
He's a rhino.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So it's just, we're not geared for that type of discourse, and it's a sad situation.
Just following up on the couple quotes, I said I'd come back to the whole issue of story that you deal with. And you open the chapter before the postscript. I'm going to read one quote that says, quote, particularly within the ranks of the emergence, there has been a reaction against the idea of theological precision on the ground that the use of precise terminology often claims too much certainty, or to use the cliche, puts God into a box, unquote. This is on page 79. And then you go to make a connection between that and then the current democratic system and its emphasis on story, relating those two. And so another quote that I'll read on page 85, you said, what this does in the political world is take attention away from substantial issues and focus them on matters of aesthetics and appearance. So can you talk a little bit about how there are parallels there with both the broader political sphere and just this emphasis on how something comes across rather than actually what they're saying, and how that relates to kind of the emergent movement and evangelicalism as a whole?
Yeah. I think to be nicely neutral on this, I'll give an example of where I think story has triumphed over what I would regard as good, common, sound political sense on both sides of the aisle.
Okay.
The rise of Sarah Palin. You know, here's a woman who seems to have, from what I've heard of her interviews, only a very remote grasp of economics, never seems to rise above the level of homely cliches whenever she's talking about anything, has next to no knowledge, it seems to me, of foreign affairs, and yet is a serious contender, apparently, or could be a serious contender, for the presidency of the United States in a couple of years' time. Why? Because she fits into that rugged, maverick, individual, etc., storyline, mm-hmm. and she knows which cliches work within the story. The grizzly bear mum thing recently mm-hmm. being a great example of that. Utterly meaningless advert, but seems to have really struck a chord with people. And that's concerning. On the other side of it, you could say President Obama. Here's a guy who got minimal political experience. He came from the Senate to the presidency, which is...
just a few years.
Yeah, which is not unprecedented, but a slightly unusual move because as I read American history, by and large, it's kind of governors mm-hmm. who tend to go to the presidency because they're the ones generals. With the real managerial mm-hmm. experience. So you have a man with minimal managerial experience rising to the presidency, being greeted in almost messianic terms when he arrives, mainly down to the fact he's an African-American. I mean, mm-hmm. he's a very articulate and intelligent guy. My concern about him would be he's probably 10 years too early to make a really decent president because he just doesn't have that much experience. And he's doomed to fail because the expectations were so high and the economy is so terrible. Mm. So that would be good examples to me of where a story has really put into positions of authority or potential authority people who are not really qualified to hold those positions. Mm-hmm. The problem there, I think, is that the stories capture the imagination. Mm-hmm. And politics is more than story. Politics involves actually doing certain things. It involves having a grasp of how to manage people. It involves having a grasp of foreign affairs. It involves having a grasp of economic realities. These are not stories as such.
Right.
They are empirical factors. Mm-hmm. And I think one needs to always think critically about the stories that we all buy into,
right.
relating them to other factors as well. I can't remember the second half of question, Jared.
The parallel with evangelicalism. I mean, we have a very strong view, especially here at Westminster, for biblical theology and in the story of what God's doing throughout history. But that can also be misused within evangelicalism. And you make that connection as well, that appearance sometimes trumps, or a lot of times trumps, substance in broader evangelicalism.
Yeah, I think you see that in the cult of celebrity and personality we have in even in Reformed conservative evangelicalism. Yeah, I don't want to restrict it to the Joel Osteens. I think we all need to stand under the condemnation of that. Clearly, again, for evangelicalism and Reformed, story is very important. I think all four of us around this table, if we're not members of the OPC now, have roots in the OPC. If ever there was a denomination that's dominated by the story of its founding and its founding fathers, it's the OPC.
Yeah.
And we would be blind to ignore that. But it shouldn't blind us to the OPC's faults. The fact that we have a great story to tell doesn't mean it's an entirely and unequivocally good story mm-hmm. to tell. I think we can see the power of story in Ted Haggart.
Yeah,
fell from grace. Now he's already founded a church again.
Benny Hinn as well. Right?
Benny Hinn. You know, success is the great sacrament of forgiveness in these kind of stories. If you can succeed, mm-hmm. you've obviously been forgiven. Mm-hmm. That's the story. And that's the story that America tells itself, of course. Success is the sign of blessing. It doesn't matter what I've done. If I plant a church, I could immediately gather 200 people around me. Clearly the Lord's blessing my ministry.
Job syndrome.
Yeah. And that's part of an uncritically held to story that is highly problematic.
I have just a practical question about when I listened when I'm on my way to school in the morning, we'll listen to NPR and get frustrated.
And really, I never get frustrated when I listen to NPR.
Me either. I must be really to the left. Right. I must be a nut job.
Right. And then when I go home from lunch, I usually listen to a right-wing radio program, and I get frustrated. And so
I think you're probably in a good place then, John.
So
the key is frustration here. Right, that's the goal.
So I think you briefly mentioned periodicals and magazines in the book. What would you say is just a good practical magazine that you think is a lot more precise in its politics? It's not full of a lot of cliches, or are they all kind of guilty across the spectrum? You just got to filter everything through.
I think there's an element of filtering in anything you read because everything is written from a perspective.
Right.
It doesn't mean it isn't objective, but it isn't neutral.
Right.
And by objective, I mean it doesn't mean that you can't read it and assess it by established canons of historical verifiability, et cetera, et cetera. I think there are various good magazines out there. Where America scores highly, I think, is on the quality of its magazines. I mean, on the literary side, you've got things like The Atlantic and The New Yorker that do deal with some political themes. I think The New Republic has good articles in it. Then, if you're looking for a very left-wing magazine, The Nation has some good articles in it. I tend these days to look at certain what I would regard as reputable websites. Probably some of your listeners will say these aren't reputable websites, but
do you get your news from The Onion?
I don't get it from the. I get it from Private Eye, which is the British equivalent.
Or Slate. Slate has some good articles every once in a while.
I was going to say Slate, Salon, Politico. Can I mention the Huffington Post?
I knew you were going to mention
Daily
that.
Daily Beast.
Yeah.
MoveOn.org.
The National. I even read things like the National Catholic Reporter. There are some religious. The Christian Science Monitor often has some good articles in it. Mm-hmm. The mainstream dailies are available online.
Faith Magazine.
The Guardian.
I'm curious to hear an English perspective on The Economist.
Incredibly boring, I would say. I've always been more
Do you think that's why they don't put the author's name in there, just so none of them get tagged with the boring label?
But the substance, that's what we really want to deal with. It's not the appearance, but the substance.
It is, and it is a very substantial magazine.
Okay.
The only magazine I subscribe to hard copy is actually the British Spectator, which is a conservative magazine and just has very good quality political writing in it. You can get most of it online. And I would recommend The Spectator. It does cover world events as well as more specifically British things. Actually, the one thing when my dad died, he died halfway through his annual Spectator subscription, so I inherited it from my dad.
Wow.
And sort of fell in love with it then and continued the subscription when it expired. But that's a good magazine with good writing, generally on the conservative side of things.
Hmm. So other than reading and analyzing and being critical, what advice or at least suggestions would you have for this upcoming political season? We've only got here a few more months until actually quite substantial events going to happen. Congress is up for grabs, so to speak. What do we do as we prepare for another election season as Christians who also are citizens of the United States?
I think as citizens, you should vote. That goes as basic. I think good citizenship really requires some kind of vote. Even if you spoil your ballot paper, as I've done back home on one occasion when I was so outraged with all of the candidates, and I wrote "No to the European Union" on it, stuck it in the box.
That'll show them.
I think you should vote.
Yes,
and I think you should be as informed as you can about the various issues. I don't think you should allow any single issue to so dominate your political thinking that it forecloses discussion and thought about other issues.
Mm.
The hot button one here for Christians is obviously abortion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I don't want to get too deeply involved in discussing that here. I am implacably opposed to abortion. What I would say is that an outsider, it doesn't seem to me that the Republicans have done any better than the Democrats over the years. As an outsider, it seems to me that the abortion rhetoric is trotted out at election time and then shoved into the drawer somewhere for the rest of the time.
Until a judge comes up.
Yeah, judicial appointment.
There even has been George H.W. Bush, who appointed some judges, pro-life people weren't so happy with. So, yeah. I mean, that doesn't always – the person you vote for who might say they're pro-life doesn't necessarily mean they're going to
– George W. Bush's state appointments were pretty moderate, if I can use that term, in terms of the whole political spectrum on pro-life issues. So it's a much more – I think the pro-life issue is the way it works out in party politics – is much more equivocal than many Christian leaders will tell you it is. For many, the Republicans are opposed to abortion, Democrats are pro it, so you've got to vote Republican. I actually think it's more complicated than that, and you probably need to make inquiries of the specific candidates who are standing.
Right.
Look at their voting records. If that's your issue, you need to look at the voting records of the people that you may be voting for if they're available.
So, and just piggybacking off of that, then, you know, we don't want to say that one particular system is the Christian position on something. Does that mean then that, you know, the political sphere is in the realm of Christian liberty, that it's kind of up to one's conscience, how you want to vote and how you want to align yourself? Or is it even more nuanced than that? I mean, you mentioned abortion is kind of a non-negotiable, if you like, but... But yeah, how do we view those things?
I think that's a very complicated and nuanced issue. I'm aware there are certain debates going on between kind of, to use cliches, broadly speaking, theonomic types and two kingdoms types.
Right.
I think quite often those debates take place at such a high level, they're of little use to the ordinary guy in church who's got to go and cast his vote.
Right.
Next, is it Tuesday you vote on here? It's Thursday back home. I think it's Tuesday,
first
isn't it?
Tuesday,
yeah. You can debate two kingdoms and theonomy all you like, but the typical guy in the pew who's got to go and cast his vote isn't going to get many of the arguments that are put forward like that. So I think it is, in practice, it is more nuanced and complicated than just saying we remove all politics from church. We should remove party politics from church, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're going to have to make a statement on a lot of moral issues that will, when you go into the voting booth, will have political ramifications for the way people think and vote. So I'm not sure that you can make the clean break in the way that some, particularly the more radical Two Kingdom guys, would like to make the break. I do think the Bible has something to say about poverty. I do think it has something to say about abortion. And bottom line is, when you go into the voting booths, your opinions on those things are going to have an influence on how you cast your vote, even if no single one of them is absolutely decisive.
Mm. Excellent. Well, thank you so much for stopping by to talk about this book. Again, it is titled Republicrat, Confessions of a Liberal Conservative, and it is available for pre-order now at WTSbooks.com. I believe it will be actually shipping maybe in about a month, September.
I think September 1st is the date they show 1st. On there, yeah.
Excellent.
Which is great. Yeah.
We look forward to that. So thank you for coming on the program and giving us an advance copy so that we could take a look at it. And it's been a pleasure. Thank you for your insights.
Thanks for having me.
Again, you can visit Westminster online at WTS.edu, YouTube.com/Westminster Online, and Facebook.com/Westminster Online. And of course, Reform Forum is available at reformedforum.org. There you'll find links to all of our sites, to our stable of content, and find information about our other programs as well as how to subscribe to them. But thank you so much for listening. We hope you join us again next time on the Reformed Media Review. But until then, tola lege, pick up and read.